The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us at danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes. Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. I want to get to the Supreme Court case that has redefined sex in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, of course, when we're going to do that with David French. But I also want to take note of this Everett Piper. Remember Everett Piper? He used to be the president at Oklahoma Wesleyan University, excoriating evangelical pastors who were pandering to Black Lives Matter. Not because of the idea of promoting racial justice, of course, which Everett Piper is an advocate for, but because Black Lives Matter, if you read their own manifesto, is a neo-Marxist group. And you can be for equality under the law and the proper treatment of all Americans by police without having to hew the orthodoxy of Black Lives Matter. And it seems that there are many that are confused. And so it continues, and as far as I'm concerned. This statement by a couple of dozen evangelical scholars condemning racism as contrary to the evangelical gospel. Yeah, we know. If you feel compelled to give a water is wet statement about racism and you're an evangelical scholar, then you're doing it wrong, as far as I'm concerned, or a religious scholar of any denomination. You don't respond to vacuous virtue signaling with its kind. You respond with substance. And this seems to me like the former, not the latter. But that's me. You know, I'm mean-spirited. So let's talk to David French, who's a more generous sort. David French, who's a constitutional lawyer, Operation Iraqi Freedom veteran, and, of course, is also senior editor at The Dispatch and a columnist for Time as well. David, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, so start with the evangelical scholars and Everett Piper's lambasting of evangelical pastors who were sort of walking in lockstep with Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between Black Lives Matter without the caps and Black Lives Matter with the capitals.
Yes.
To a specific group, and that group is extremely radical. They call for the destruction of, you know, the Western prescribed nuclear families. You know, they respect and honor some people, cop killers who fled to Cuba back in the 60s and 70s. They're extremely radical, but the, you know, 90% of the people or greater who are saying Black Lives Matter don't know about any of that. Think of it in the lowercase sense, not about the actual group itself. And so, yeah, that the group Black Lives Matter is extremely radical. The concept, the thought, the argument Black Lives Matter is something different from the way people are chanting it and saying it is different from endorsing that group.
Although, but both whether you do first letter caps or not, to me, it strikes me as a straw man argument for the reasonable, respectful person. Yeah, I know. Every life matters. That's my position. That's what I believe. And that's what obviously men and women of the cloth believe, men and women of faith believe. So since there's no argument, what are we arguing about?
Well, I think that the problem you have is is that when you have a problem of police brutality and that problem is falling disproportionately on the Black population, I think the implication in the slogan is not that Black Lives Matter more, that Black Lives also matter. They matter equally. I think that's the intention of what people are chanting and what people are saying. And I don't think the intention is to endorse that group that I would say probably even 99% of the people who are marching don't even know what that group stands for.
But they do know what a lot of the protesters are demanding. This is whether you know about the group or not. And all the demands from most quarters are of the identitarian kind, which we've been seeing over the last 50 years, starting incubating on college campuses and Shelby Steele's day all the way to everywhere today, which is I am making a demand for power based on my identity. And if you don't accede to that, now not everybody is taking this position, but some are. If you don't accede to that, then I have the right, the moral obligation even, to burn it down. Nicole Hannah-Jones redefining theft as a symbolic taking, saying violence is wrong in reasonable times, but these aren't reasonable times. And she's a black scholar, a Pulitzer Prize winner. So you can't just relegate this to people who are capitalizing on the opportunity to steal.
Yeah, I think what you have is a problem where, as so often happens, that you have an illiberal or an authoritarian, or as you would call it, identitarian element that is attempting to hijack a movement that is not motivated by those concerns. So, for example, if you look at actual reform proposals outside of the folks at the Minneapolis City Council who've passed this toothless, thankfully so far, resolution to defund and abolish the Minneapolis Police Department, the vast majority of like the actual concrete political reforms that are being proposed are political reforms that a lot of people from across the spectrum have been seeking for a while, like end of qualified immunity, dramatic limits on no-knock raids, and things along those lines, which are extremely reasonable. And then you have an element of the argument that is basically saying, hey, look, if you don't buy into every single aspect of what we say about everything from anti-racism to the form of protest that we prescribe, then you need to lose your job, or you need to be silenced, or you need to be canceled. And so there's this illiberal element of this that is taken over, and particularly, and is dominant particularly in a lot of progressive quarters that are keeping center-left people who are sort of looking for these reasonable political solutions, is really bringing the hammer down on those people. Like there was an individual who shared information that protests that are nonviolent tend to be more effective than protests that are violent. He lost his job from a progressive data gathering organization, which is absurd, which is totally ridiculous. And that's, you know, one of the things that ends up happening in this really negatively polarized environment we're in is that every time you have a movement that sort of grabs the American middle, and this one has, I mean, the polling is unbelievable on how much it has grabbed the great bulk of the American people. And then you're going to have those voices who are like, who are trying from the edges to pull it all to them and being incredibly intolerant and illiberal at the same time. And you have that out there. And fortunately, it has not leaked into the major political proposals of either party yet. Again, with the exception of like some of the city councils here and there that have not quite yet enacted the most radical things they've talked about. But yeah, it's there. It's there. It's very real. It's extremely intolerant and it's extremely angry. And especially they just don't allow dissent in their own communities, the communities they control. And I think that has a real risk for a movement that's grabbed a big chunk of the American people.
In the 6-3 decision, Bostick v. Clayton County yesterday, sex is memorialized in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was expanded to include sexual orientation and sexual identity. Rod Dreher, writing in the American Conservative, said this: "It is hard to overstate the magnitude of this decision and the size of the loss to religious and social conservatives. SCOTUS has declared that homosexuality and transgenderism are like race. If you disagree, you are on the side of Klansmen, in effect. This is not just the opinion of Democrat lawmakers or columnists at the New York Times. This is now the law of the land. And it became the law of the land thanks to two Republican justices, Roberts and Gorsuch, who were loyal to their class in the clutch."
That's a lot much. What the ultimate outcome for religious liberty is not yet known, because we have a number of cases pending where the outcome seems promising regarding the extent to which religious liberty protections may be enhanced in coming months. We've got a case involving the ministerial exception, which could be expanded to just a purely functional test, which means that religious organizations are going to be able to define who quote-unquote ministers are, not just people who've been trained theologically, but have a function that is to advance the faith and to teach the principles of the faith. And those people will be completely exempt from all operations of all non-discrimination laws. Justice Gorsuch noted in his own opinion that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act acts as a kind of, the quote was, a super statute that modifies even Title VII, the very statute they were writing about. So to call the demise of the religious liberty is a little premature. We're going to know an awful lot more in about a year, because there was another very big case the Supreme Court took involving the religious liberty of adoption agencies and foster agencies that in conflict with non-discrimination statutes, where I think it's probable, I mean, you know, maybe not, but I think the reason the court took it is to protect religious liberty. Could be wrong about that, but there's a lot of movement on that's positive on religious liberty. So I think to say that that's over now is way premature, and I think it's just wrong to say it's because of Gorsuch's social class. I'm really tired of people saying someone did something that disagreed with me, and it was for reasons that were not intellectually honest and corrupt, because why? Is that the only reason you can disagree? And no, I think that's a little much.
When we come back with constitutional lawyer David French, I want to get to the Twitter thread that you posted with respect to Gorsuch's definition of his own textualism versus Alito's original public meeting approach to interpreting Constitution and federal statutory law. More with David French when we return.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
We're back with author, constitutional lawyer, senior editor at thedispatch.com, David French. And I want to get to what you said on Twitter with respect to Gorsuch's definition of his own textualism and Alito's original public meaning approach to the Constitution and to federal statutory law, and how those two ran into conflict with one another in this case. Break that down for us, if you would.
Yeah, so what happened here is that the plaintiffs in the case aimed their whole argument directly at Neil Gorsuch, because they knew that there were distinctions between him and some of the other judges and how they look at statutes. So basically, both Gorsuch and Alito started from the same starting place. The word sex used in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 means what sex meant in 1964, biological. It's a fixed biological definition. It's not a definition modified by gender. But then what Alito did is he said, well, wait a minute, okay, let's take that definition. The meaning of that, what that's going to mean for how the statute is going to operate, is still going to be defined by how the drafters thought the statute should operate. And in 1964, none of them thought that this would apply to sexual orientation, and they didn't even know what gender identity was. And then Gorsuch said, so sex means what sex means, and so let's talk about what sex means in the context of these cases. And the way he described it was, if you had a guy who brings, like, say, to a company picnic, a man as a date, and you had a woman who brings to a company picnic a man as a date, and the employer fires the man who brought the man as a date, he's saying, well, you're treating the man differently from the woman, even though they engaged in the same action, taking, you know, a man to the company picnic. So while sex is not the only reason for the action, it is inherently part of the reason for the action, and then therefore the Civil Rights Act applies, whether the drafters intended that result or not. And Alito says, essentially, wait a minute, no, that's not how you read statutes. A statute should not reach a result that the drafters do not intend. And Alito also took aim at Gorsuch's reasoning by also saying, well, if a employer has a policy that says no gay workers, they don't know the sex of the worker when they promulgate the policy. So how could that be based in sex? And then Gorsuch would respond, but on any given worker that they apply it to, there would be an element of this that was based on sex. And so that's what the argument was about. And people knew that this, after the oral argument in this case, most people who were close court watchers knew this was where Gorsuch was leaning. This was not a surprise to anybody, in my view, who's been a close court watcher. So I think that what you're talking about is the differences in approaches to textualism. That Gorsuch would say, look, if the words are the words, and if they reach a meaning that the drafters didn't intend, that's not the we've spent a lot of time trying to look at what words mean, and rather than what was in the minds of the people who drafted the statute. And Alito would say, well, wait, if this reaches a meaning that was not the original intended public meaning of this statute, then that's a problem. And that's what it ended up being the debate about.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I guess the predicate question would be, if there's a disagreement about specific intent, or there's a desire to make sure that there's clarity on intent there, then is not the purview of the legislative body and not the judicial one.
Right. One of the original problem here is that you have a very broad sweeping statute, just really broad, it's short and broad, basically. And one of the ironies is that the word sex was actually, a lot of scholars and a lot of observers of the original bill would said that the word sex was actually injected as a poison pill into the bill to try to scuttle it. So that, there was a legislator who said, I'm opposed to the Civil Rights Act. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to make an amendment that's going to just make this thing too broad and people will not agree to pass it. Well, it got passed anyway with his poison pill element in it. And so all of a sudden you have this bill, this law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, on the same basis that it bans discrimination on the basis of race, even though the two things are not the same thing. One of these things is not like the other.
Between Alito and Gorsuch, how do you come down in this case if you were in one of the black robes?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been much more on the Alito. I've generally been more on the Alito side of statutory constitutional interpretation. But, the differences between the two of them are pretty finely sliced in any given case. I think the other thing that made this tip this over for Gorsuch is that there had been a lot of case law, a lot of stare decisis between now and then that had really sort of said, wait a minute, we're just going to take this word sex for what the word is, and it includes, it includes disparate treatment on the basis of motherhood, it includes disparate treatment on the basis of stereotyping, includes disparate treatment, like it includes sexual harassment of men as much as women. And so there was a lot of case law developing here that made this case, as soon as the Supreme Court took it, I thought, oh man, this is a lot closer. A lot of people were thinking, well, this is one where the conservative majority of the court is going to narrow the definition of Title VII. I can't
look at this, though, without saying that potentially, the sort of the cultural norms and the direction they're heading had some influence. Because, I mean, you look at this I believe it was Alito noted, the EEOC, well known for its adventurous interpretations, failed to see what Gorsuch contends is obvious for the first 48 years after Title VII became law. So this is, essentially reacting to a recent phenomenon.
Yeah, well, and that's the way the law develops a lot of the time. So, for example, the courts only decide cases that are brought before it. And so, I would say for 20 years, nobody thought to bring a case making the argument of sex-based discrimination like that or more. You often see that in case law where we don't know about the reach of the statute until cases are brought to define the reach of the statute. And that's the Second Amendment hopefully develops, that the Supreme Court really, really took a baseball bat to the Second Amendment yesterday.
Well, I wish we had time for that. But I mean, I would just on this case, I would say, the Second Amendment is, enshrined in the Constitution. We've got a lot of jurisprudence on that. We've only been arguing about pronoun usage for the past 5 minutes. So this is a little bit of a quick trigger for the court. But I appreciate your constitutional insights and insights into the jurisprudence of the competing jurists in this case. I think it's helpful. David French, senior editor at The Dispatch, columnist for Time, author of Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat, and How to Restore Our Nation, that is scheduled for release September 22nd. So look for that. David, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you. And I'm wondering what it is I should do. It's so hard to keep this mask.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Our friend over at the Foundation for Economic Education, John Miltimore, had a good piece about a recent interview that Stanford medical doctor and medical researcher, Dr. John Ioannidis, gave to Michael Smirkanish on CNN, reminding us that in 2010, The Atlantic said that Dr. John Ioannidis may be one of the most influential scientists alive in a profile piece on him. But as of March, he was persona non grata among many in the media because he challenged the received wisdom about the models as to what the case fatality rate would be and thus the death totals as a result of the COVID-19 infection. Dr. John Ioannidis on Smirkanish, as I mentioned, explaining what we know 3 months in, or so, I mean 6 months in really, but since sort of lockdown policies as the predicate to suggest why lockdown policies need to end.
For the average person being infected, the risk of having severe disease and the risk of dying is much lower than we thought. So it is a common and mild infection. At the same time, it can be a devastating infection. There's no doubt about this. But by now, we have learned where exactly it hits and where it can be devastating. It can be devastating for when it hits nursing homes. It can be devastating when it hits hospitals, infects personnel, physician staff, and then we have hospitalized patients getting infected. We see that paradox in many people, for example, in children and in young adults. It is less severe than the common flu. In middle-aged people, it's about the same. In nursing homes and in hospitals that get infected massively, it can be a disaster. So we can use that knowledge to try to navigate into that spectrum, try the settings and the individuals who are at highest risk, same time, probably have some optimism about the prospects of reopening our society before we get many adverse consequences by prolonged lockdown measures.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Thomas Yadiger. He is a pulmonologist and medical director of the intensive care unit at Providence Cedars Sinai Tarzana Medical Center. That's in L.A. Dr. Yadiger, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. Good morning. How are you?
Good. Did Dr. Ioannidis give a fair representation of what we understand about COVID-19 at present?
I believe so. There is definitely a bimodal distribution for this disease. And one of the things that I've been begging for is for better reporting of data from nursing homes. You know, in our in my experience, in March and April, almost exclusively all the patients that were being admitted to our hospitals were from the community, what we call community transfers. In the month of May, that really switched over when there was social isolation, staying at home orders that went into effect in March. We saw the community rates, as expected, go down. Unfortunately, our concern was always the outbreaks in nursing homes, and we're surrounded by several large nursing homes. And what we saw was in the month of May, almost exclusively all of our cases that were coming to our hospital were from nursing homes. And it's a significantly different disease in patients from the community versus patients from the nursing home. And the mortality is vastly different. So I think, you know, to make good, sound public health policies, that data needs to be reported for patients and for the community. If someone wants to take their wife out for an anniversary dinner, they need to know what you know, what the case rate is. And right now, everything is lumped in to one sum. And, you know, obviously, if there's an outbreak in a nursing home, you know, those patients don't go out in the community, and those patients aren't at risk, you know, for transmitting the patients. So it really needs to be better differentiated. And I think, you know, unfortunately, that's not the case right now.
When we come back, I want to pick up on this piece that you wrote for RealClearHealth.com, because I haven't heard it quite described this way before, the COVID-19 virus, that is. It's a tale of two diseases, you write. A known viral infection, okay, we understand that, but also a subsequent immune-mediated syndrome in a subset of critically ill patients, like you were just describing, nursing home patients. And I just want you to unpack that in layman's terms so we can appreciate the point that you're making and the importance of it. More with Dr. Thomas Yadigar, pulmonologist and medical director for the intensive care unit at Providence Cedar Sinai Tarzana Medical Center in L.A. right after this.
Good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're talking to Dr. Thomas Yadigar, and I mentioned this op-ed that you wrote for RealClearHealth.com, A Tale of Two Diseases. The viral infection is one. The subsequent immune-mediated syndrome in a subset of critically ill patients. Describe that second tale, if you will, of the disease.
Sure, of course. So obviously everyone knows that the SARS-CoV-2 is a virus, and just like the influenza virus can cause a viral pneumonia and also can cause respiratory failure. But what was interesting and what we saw in our patient population, and again, this was especially the patients, healthy patients that were coming from the community, was that they were developing a different type of a syndrome altogether. This was one where the virus triggers the immune system, and instead of the immune system fighting in a coherent, organized way to defeat the virus, it actually triggers the immune system to start fighting and destroying the patient's own organs. So what we were seeing is that it wasn't the actual virus causing a direct injury to the lung. It was actually the patient's own immune system that was now starting to attack the patient's lung. And obviously the treatment is vastly different because at this point you're not looking to treat with an antiviral medication. And what you have to treat with a medication is to suppress the patient's immune system. This is something that's really strongly counterintuitive in my 20 years of doing critical care work. You know, we always try to boost the patient's immune system because most of our patients in the ICU that eventually succumb, one of the biggest risks is infections. So the last thing you want to do is suppress someone's immune system. But we learned very early on that this was occurring in the patients, and this isn't a novel idea. You know, other viruses can do this as well and can cause immune-mediated syndromes. It was just that the SARS-CoV-2 virus does it very, very proficiently. In the first month and a half, 2 months, again, the majority of our patients were coming from the community, and the majority of patients that we're seeing in the ICU that were really critically ill, that were going on ventilators, it was due to this process and not the virus causing direct injury. Now, that obviously can happen and does happen. And that's the difficult part, is to differentiate it, because if it's the virus that's causing direct injury and killing the patient, then the last thing you want to do is suppress the immune system. But if the virus has come along, triggered the immune system, and now the immune system is causing all the damage, then you need to give the immune system the immunosuppressive medications. Otherwise, your patient's going to succumb to it.
I don't know why I lost command of the English language, immune-mediated syndrome. I just never saw that phraseology exactly. But yeah, so and you make the point on the immune-mediated syndrome, that second aspect of it, that there's no singular test for that, too. So it's really a doctor's judgment call on whether or not you're seeing an expression of the viral infection or the subsequent immune-mediated syndrome.
Yeah, that's been the most difficult part to train other doctors. I supervise 20 different physicians, and we work at two different hospitals. And that aspect of it has been very difficult because it is what we call a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that you have to evaluate for other disorders, other kind of things that can do it, you know, other bacterial pneumonias, other types of diseases that can cause this. And once you've ruled those out, then you have to, you know, actively start treating the patients for this disease. There are certain laboratory markers. These are what we call inflammatory markers that we check. These are not part of the routine part test that we normally look for critically ill patients. And that was the other thing that we had to learn very rapidly, to start looking for these types of inflammatory markers. Because a normal test that we check when someone's critically ill, those will all came back normal with COVID-19.
So there's been a medical development that was announced this morning out of University of Oxford, New York Times reporting that a steroid, dexamethasone, reduced deaths by a third in patients receiving ventilation and by one-fifth in patients receiving only oxygen treatment. They found no benefit from the drug in patients who did not need respiratory support. This is a 6,000-patient trial. So it would seem that if this science checks out, that this therapeutic would be really important to addressing that second aspect of the disease that you were describing.
Yes, it's obviously very exciting news. I think that still the devil's in the detail. But dexamethasone is an immunosuppressive medication. It's actually a very, very strong one. In a subset of patients, we were already using different types. We were using hydrocortisone for patients that had problems with their blood pressure, and we're also using solumedrol as part of a well-established trial for acute lung injury. But dexamethasone is much, much stronger than those medications. And, if the data is proven to be true, then this would be, you know, revolutionary and can obviously help a lot of people.
This may be sort of beyond your ken and not your understanding, but just your focus. But I wonder if you saw the study out of the University Hospital in Zurich, Switzerland, that suggests that antibodies may only appear in the most severe COVID-19 cases, which is about 1 in 5, that you may have upwards of 60% of people who are naturally resistant to the virus based on the presence of antibodies or the lack thereof in less severe cases, and how that would inform our understanding of the infection rate and case fatality rate.
I actually haven't seen that actual study. I know that there's been a lot of diverse opinion about antibody testing, and we've obviously seen the part of the problem comes that there's so many different ways of checking the antibodies. There isn't one uniform laboratory test that's been approved, so it makes it difficult to pass any judgment. And but from the science standpoint, if you are exposed to a virus, any type of virus, any type of infection, your immune system should produce antibodies, and under normal circumstances, those antibodies should be protective for at least a certain amount of time. Now, whether it's lifelong or not, obviously no one knows, but if you do get an infection, you should produce antibodies.
He is Dr. Thomas Yadigar. He's a pulmonologist and medical director of the intensive care unit at Providence Cedars-Sinai Tarzana Medical Center in L.A., and I will tweet out at Dan Prof Show his piece from realclearhealth.com, COVID-19, a tale of two diseases that we were discussing. Dr. Yadigar, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Dan, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Looking for a consensus on public servants, former elected officials to be honored in monument form around our nation's cities and state capitals. I got an idea. Came to me from this piece at insider.com. Also, perhaps some instruction on who should be governing us. It's fact that small towns in California, Minnesota, Colorado, Kentucky have all had dog mayors. I mean D-O-G, not D-A-W-G. For example, Sonol, California. For 13 years, Bosco, a black lab Rottweiler, was mayor. Bosco defeated two human beings to win the 1981 election, running as a Republican. See what they did. With campaign promises including a bone in every dish, a cat in every tree, and a fire hydrant in every corner, according to the Mercury News reporting at the time, back when hard news was the order of the day. He passed away while in office in 94. He did go missing for a week in 1987, but not Mark Sanford style. He ambled back in with two new flea collars rewarded with some beef jerky, and he continued to govern that community. Or, for example, Lucy Liu, a border collie who was the first female mayor of Rabbit Hash, Kentucky, served honorably for 8 years from 2008 to 2016. The slogan, "The bitch you can count on." Yeah, it's memorable. She stepped down from her role to run for president in 2016 unsuccessfully. Just wasn't right in that wave, that revolt election year. Let's maybe one more example of this to get to my point. How about Max, a golden retriever, elected mayor of Idlewild, California in 2013? He took over from another golden retriever, also called Max, a bit of a dynasty, went from Max to Maximus Mighty Dog Mueller II. The town's election is also modeled as a fundraiser for a local animal rescue nonprofit. A Duke, a Great Pyrenees, was the first elected mayor of Cormorant Village, Minnesota in 2014, reelected three times. See, these are popular local officials in addition to successful ones, and perhaps the secret to their success, they enjoy the consent of the governed. And, I must say, looking through this impressive list of dog mayors, just in recent memory across our country, you think monuments to replace the human beings, number one. You also think, paraphrasing the great William F. Buckley, that, I would rather be ruled by the first 2,000 dogs listed in the American Kennel Club directory than the entire faculty at Harvard. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Prof Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Follow us at danproftshow.com for podcasts of the program, and on social media at Dan Proft Show as well, Facebook and Twitter. So the debates are ongoing, both at the federal level, as well as we know, in the states at many local levels. That is the debate over how police departments should be reformed, if they should be reformed at all, if they shouldn't just be shuttered and policing completely reimagined in the wake of the systemic racism that afflicts police departments, according to the likes of Mayor Fry and Ilhan Omar in Minneapolis, according to the Independent Nation of Chaz in Seattle, according to the Democrat political hierarchy in this country more generally. Let's address what FOP President Cannizzaro said first.
I almost would caution any member to do not pursue anybody. You're basically risking your job, your livelihood, and your freedom.
So now what are police to do? So they shouldn't pursue anybody, and then somebody's going to catch a police officer not pursuing a suspect, and that suspect doing something to hurt someone else, and then the police officer is going to be blamed for not pursuing the suspect. Why didn't you do your job? So I shouldn't pursue, I should pursue, you know, and there are going to be complicated events as an example, of course, the Rayshard Brooks shooting in Atlanta on Friday night. But we know from the research in this area, this is not a unknown matter. And by the way, the research includes from Roland Fryer, Harvard economist, a black gentleman, that you put police on their heels, you put them in the fetal position, as it was once described under Rahm Emanuel, and you unleash violence. Where? In disproportionately in the neighborhoods that are already suffering under the weight and the threat of violence by the few against the many. For more professional perspective on this, former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, author of Cops Under Fire, or Cop Under Fire, excuse me, moving beyond hashtags of race, crime, and politics for a better America. Sheriff Clark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's always my pleasure.
I mean, just give us your top line commentary and what you've seen the last 2 weeks and both the civil unrest and with these police-involved shootings that, or killings that have led to the unrest.
I believe, having studied this anarchist movement going back to the 60s and even before that in socialist takeovers over in Europe, that there's a sinister plot here that's being unfolded, and these police incidents are being used as a rally point to foment hate and anger in disparate groups and then unleashing them on the American people. Now, one of the things that has to happen for that to be successful, we saw it during the 60s, one of the things that has to happen is they have to have police on their heels, as you mentioned. The police are the only thing that stands between the rule of law and order in a civil society, and so that's why they attack the police. It has nothing to do with systemic racism in the police department. That does not exist, by the way. It has nothing to do with racism. It has nothing to do with white privilege or white superiority. One of the other tactics they like to use is they create slogans that people can rally around and then march down the street shouting. They don't make any sense. They couldn't put a coherent thought together if you ask them what the problem was. And so this is the whole chaotic situation. And then when you have poor leadership, you throw that in there, you've got poor police leadership, you have poor political leadership, which we haven't had in the past. And that's why we've always been able to neutralize these things when they've happened. But now you have the political class jumping on board. You have the political class hating on the police. You're the political class going along with these inane suggestions like defunding and abolishing the police. And you throw all this together and you have the ingredients for a country that's on fire. I agree with the FOP, the Chicago FOP's head. It's not worth it anymore. It's just not worth it for these law enforcement officers. They're on the front line. They're in harm's way. They don't have the resources. They don't have the political support. It's not worth going to jail over. They're firing cops summarily right on the spot when they're involved in any type of use of force. Look at Buffalo, where they just pushed the guy back. That's all they did. And the two officers not only were fired immediately, they were charged. So I agree with him. It is time for the police to push back. And one of the ways, the most effective ways to push back in a situation like this is let these communities see what life would be like without them.
Well, and I'll tell you, it's interesting, too, because the whole cut the police budgets by 50% and use that money to fund social welfare programs. Oh, I see. So we're going to cut the police budgets to pour more money onto the $30 trillion we've spent on Great Society programs since 1965 and have produced what results? Even as the representation of black Americans in office has increased exponentially during the 55 years. And yet the quality of life for so many black residents and so many black urban centers has actually declined during the time period where we have more black representation in public office. And we have spent trillions upon trillions of dollars on the programs they said would alleviate poverty and inequalities.
Now they're suggesting spending more money. Money's the problem. Money created a dependency class. You know, you mentioned the $30 trillion since the 1960s war on poverty. Now, once again, and all these cities are talking about taking money from the police and giving it to social service programs. This is a joke. Joe Biden the other day suggested $300 million spending for child care and jobs training. We have done that to death. It's not going to work. They're working on the wrong things. They need a behavior change in the underclass. And they're afraid to look them in the eye and say, that's enough, no more, you guys need to clean up your act. Here's the way to get ahead. Raise your damn kids, get an education, become employed, get a skill, some sort of trade, whatever, go on and get degrees, get into the mainstream here, the mainstream, and start to compete. Because the Democrats use these folks for votes, they don't want their lives to get better. Can't people see this?
Is there are there any of the reforms that are being bandied about, including by Tim Scott, Republican senator from South Carolina, that you would support? Some stuff to me seems fairly obvious. We have weaponized non-law enforcement agencies. I don't know why, education departments and other agencies have to have so much military equipment or law enforcement equipment when they're not law enforcement agencies. I don't like administrative agencies that get weaponized, for example. There's also discussions about SWAT teams in smaller communities. Are those really necessary? And then a bigger one and a more controversial one, amending or removing the qualified immunity that police officers have, or doing something, as Tim Scott had proposed, in that direction with certification and decertification of police.
In terms of some of these reforms, that's a big word now, police reform. You want to take some of the equipment away? If that's what people want to do in these communities, fine. They get to fund it, the taxpayers. We derive our authority from the consent of the governed, fine. When you need the equipment, when you don't have it and you have a barricaded subject, or you have a thing like I mentioned, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, where you got some guy in there with 1,000 rounds and he's mowing down kids like he's at a video arcade. That's when you need that stuff. Okay. You hope you don't ever have to use it, but you always want it in reserve. So I just think that would risk you to do that. If you want to certify, not certify police, state by state, I'm okay with that. In Wisconsin, you have to be certified, so I'm familiar with that. Qualified immunity, I don't know what they're talking about, because you can sue a law enforcement officer in federal court anytime you want under 1983 claims, section 1983. Here's why I think that's a smokescreen. They're throwing that out there. Let's try to do something and make it appear like we're reforming things here. When there's a lawsuit, if a law enforcement officer acts improperly, a tort lawyer will tell you this. We don't care about the police officer, for heaven's sakes. We want to sue the city and the police agency because that's who has the deep pockets. We won't get anything out of a police officer. Most of those people don't have any wealth. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I don't understand. Nobody cares about, when you get into court, about holding the police officer to account in civil court because they don't have anything. It's the city you want to sue. It's the police department you want to sue because that's where you can make the big bucks. So we need to get off this qualified immunity. But again, they don't know what they're talking about. So policing has always been a local thing. All right. If we don't want to do certain things, certain communities, fine. But that should happen at the state level, the local level, not the federal level. You can't have, we already have, by the way, standardized rules for use of force. It's all codified in Supreme Court decisions on use of force. So, and those, every agency's held to that. So when people throw that out, I heard someone the other day said we need uniform standards on use of force. We already have it, for heaven's sakes, codified in the law.
He is Sheriff David Clark, former Milwaukee County Sheriff, author of Cop Under Fire, Moving Beyond Hashtags of Race, Crime, and Politics for a Better America. Sheriff Clark, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Be well.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproffshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Remember this clip from a week or so ago, the outset of some of the protests, this large gathering in Bethesda, Maryland?
I will use my voice in the most uplifting way possible.
I will use my voice in the most uplifting way possible.
I will love my black neighbors the same as my white ones.
I will love my black neighbors the same as my white ones.
That was a great example of the cultism that is present with respect to the left and these identitarian movements. The identitarian movement, generally speaking, and all the disparate elements of it, sort of the solidarity and marginality game that identitarian political operatives play. I'll tell you what was probably present in that large gathering in Bethesda, Maryland. A lot of people who otherwise also self-identify as Christian, but their Christianity is subordinated to their commitment to politics, their actual religion, identitarian politics. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Michael Warren Davis, editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine and frequent contributor to theamericanconservative.com as well. M.W. Davis, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan.
In a recent piece in Crisis, you asked the question, God or the mob? Clearly the answer is the mob, so now we can move on from that.
Yeah, hey, I like that soundbite that you played. You know, everyone makes fun of the nuns with their rulers, but hey, I guess memorization works, and that's
yeah.
what the kids really want these days, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you're absolutely right. So, I mean, I'm sure that you've talked about Archbishop Wilton Gregory, the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., who during the protests scolded one of the shrines, the Catholic shrines in Washington, D.C., for allowing Donald Trump to visit to sign a historic executive order on religious liberty, and Archbishop Gregory said that it was inappropriate that he was going to visit a Catholic shrine in the midst of these protests because Trump's a racist or whatever. I don't know of any other instance of a Catholic archbishop telling not only a U.S. president, but anyone, any individual of any religion, that he's not allowed to visit a Catholic church. That's the insanity of these riots.
Yeah, but I mean, Archbishop Gregory is a perfect example of the insanity that has infected the Catholic Church and other faiths that you've seen roiled over identity politics, too. I mean, I talked with David French earlier in the show about sort of these symbolic acts that evangelical pastors feel they must make to announce that racism is inconsistent with Scripture. No kidding. To announce that, they also believe Black Lives Matter. Right. Again, and water is wet. If you are a man or a woman of faith, then obviously you start from the premise that we're all God's children created equally in his eyes. So you don't respond to vacuous virtue signaling with more of the same.
Absolutely. It was so silly. I mean, I'm sure that you know, after President Trump allegedly sent in the Park Service police to clear out St. John's Episcopal Church, protesters so that he could take that photo op, which was probably a political miscalculation. The Episcopal Bishop of Washington came out against him furiously. What no one talks about is the fact that the reason that the police actually cleared them out was because the protesters had tried to set fire to the church the day before. And so, the Episcopalians were defending these protesters that had tried to set fire to their own church. All of these examples of identitarianism superseding a true religion, whether it's Christian or Protestant.
Don't you find a certain Jonestown quality to all of this, too? I mean, I don't want to overstate it, and I just did. But in this sense of, I mean, I am willing to have my business torn asunder. I'm willing to have my church burned down. I'm willing to lose my job to sacrifice myself on the pyre of identity politics.
Absolutely. And I don't think that this is any conscious apostasy, I don't know, that's a strong word, on the part of Catholics and Episcopalians. I think it just arises from a mentality that religion is something that you do on Sundays and, you go and you take your little piece of bread and you listen to a nice sermon and then you go home and that's over.
When you're allowed to by the government, that is.
Oh, geez. And Archbishop Gregory of Washington was the worst offender of all. He was the one that came out and said, because the health of my flock is my number one concern, we're going to suspend masses indefinitely. The number one concern of a Catholic priest or bishop is not the health of his flock. It's whether or not his flock goes to heaven. Again, if you view religion as something that you do, it's kind of a hobby. It's a private interest. And the society may or may not tolerate it. But, at best, it's just something that you do in your own free time and you don't bother anyone else about it. So, actually, it's no little wonder that taking that mentality, that an Episcopal bishop would willingly sacrifice one of their own churches, the Church of the Presidents, St. John's Lafayette Square, to the mob to make a political statement.
You wrote a hopeful piece, and in the spirit of the day, put an ism on it so that we can actually have a conversation about it, because you can't have a conversation if it doesn't include a phobia or an ism. And you call for a return to sensibilism when it comes to legislating. It struck me as very similar to books that Robert Curry over at the Claremont Institute has written about the common sense realism that has sort of been endemic to American sensibility for most of our nation's founding, but it seems to be on the wane.
There you go. Sensibilism, realism. You need the ism. So my idea of sensibilism, which it's nothing new, and I guess that's the point, is that, I mean, I'm just really sick of politics, and I'm sure that you are too. And I think political journalists like us, you know, we get sick of it even faster than everyone else.
Yes.
But the basic idea is just that, you know, as you said, just legislate from common sense. Just make laws that, you know, you read in the newspaper. It has to pass the smell test, you know what I mean? So if you read about the law and you say, yeah, I guess that makes sense, then it stays. But if you read about the law and you say, yeah, that doesn't really make much sense to me, then the law has to go. So I guess a major example is noise pollution, right? So everyone hates, you know, loud cars, loud motorcycles. They come bombing down the street at 5 a.m. Where I live here in New Hampshire, there's a motorcycle that I use as my alarm clock every day at 4:30 a.m. It comes down the street roaring and it wakes me up, and I get up and I go to work. That shouldn't really be allowed, should it? Because the example that I use in the article, when I was right before my wife and I moved back to New Hampshire, we were in Michigan for a couple of months. I was sitting out on my porch. I was writing, and all of a sudden, this vehicle out of Mad Max came bombing down the street, and it for like five seconds. That's a long time. The night just exploded in this awful roar, and as soon as it passed, I heard my neighbor's infant child wake up and scream. You know, it was. And that shouldn't be legal. I really don't believe that, you know, some idiot bachelor's right to some loud, souped-up apocalypse mobile is more sacrosanct than an infant's right to a good night's sleep, or a parent's right to, you know, just to have their infant sleep through the night and to get a good night's sleep themselves.
Let's hold it right there, M.W. Davis. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about a return to sensibilism when it comes to governance. More with Michael Warren Davis when we return.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Back with Crisis Magazine's Michael Warren Davis, and to your example of sensibilism when it comes to governance before that you mentioned before the break, the loud motorcycle, that's why we have municipal noise ordinances, right?
Yeah, and see, these laws do exist. They're just not very, you know, they're not pursued very aggressively, and they're not ubiquitous as they should be. And another example, and this is, they have Sir Roger Scruton pioneered the Building Better, Building Beautiful Commission in the United States. And Duncan Storch, the great architect, is being contracted with the U.S. government to help build more beautiful federal buildings that fall under the auspices of the federal government. Why don't we have laws like that that extend across all of society? Why don't we have laws that say, you know, you have to, if you build a building, it has to be beautiful. No more of these concrete monstrosities like Boston City Hall or, the University of Sydney, right, my alma mater, this beautiful historic limestone university with this awful concrete block. It looks like the shrine in Mecca. that just, you know, just plopped in the middle of this beautiful Oxfordian. Why is that there? What's that? That just shouldn't be allowed, because people, this is the thing that we forget, that some people, a lot of people don't realize. And speaking of fatalism, you only have one life, and life is actually pretty short. And life is far too short to spend, you know, in a lousy, noisy, ugly city. So my philosophy, the fundamental philosophy of sensibilism, is that life, you know, it's the equal redistribution of beauty. So you have ordinances that say, you know, no, you're not allowed to drive that noisy motorcycle or car that's going to wake up some poor baby and his parents. And no, you're not allowed to build that concrete monstrosity and stick it in the middle of the city, because other innocent human beings are going to walk by and they have the right to look at something beautiful. Mm. So
the right to beauty runs into the right to private property too. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we waste so much money in the federal government. I think it would be an absolutely negligible amount of money would be required to have some sort of public fund. And look, abolish the government in every other sense, or just do this. Just set aside a couple of million dollars and have a federal fund to build facades, you know, concrete or steel facades that turn these brutalist neo-modernist architecture into something Victorian or Georgian or Art Deco, just something that's not, you know, an absolute eyesore.
Okay.
And
well,
so
long as you don't name those buildings over any of the founding fathers, then you've got a problem. He is Michael Warren Davis. He's editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine and frequent contributor to theamericanconservative.com. Michael Warren Davis, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Take care. You can find the rest of, well, I should encourage you to read the rest of Michael Warren Davis's Forget All the Isms and Just Legislate Common Sense per our discussion. Get that at theamericanconservative.com. And check out his other pieces that we reference in our discussion, God or the Mob. And he also has a good piece on police officers at crisismagazine.com. I got something else for you to check out, too. It's Patterns of Evidence, the Red Sea Miracle. This is the second in a multi-part series from investigative filmmaker Tim Mahoney, who started with the question, did the stories as written in the Bible really happen? The documentary follows Mahoney in his on his faith-affirming journey in search of evidence for one of the Bible's most epic miracles, the parting of the Red Sea. You remember the first installment was the Exodus. So if you like the Exodus, if you took my advice and saw that, you like the Exodus, then check out the latest, the Red Sea Miracle. The results of his investigation, Tim Mahoney's, are monumental. Right now, you can watch Patterns of Evidence, the Red Sea Miracle at home, along with other movies in the series. Go to patternsofevidence.com. That's patternsofevidence.com. It's just me, myself, and I. 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 Now you tease my plug one style.
Good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. As I mentioned with Michael Medved on yesterday's program, you know, I so miss Frazier, thinking about Seattle and maybe bringing back Kelsey Grammer and David Hyde Pierce to do a special Frasier edition live from Chaz. I don't know, even though, as Medved pointed out, it wasn't really ever filmed in Seattle. But nonetheless, thanks to the digital age, you can get an updated Frasier with some creative folks online for example, this offering.
Yeah, hello, my name's Roger, and I am a resident of the Nation of Chaz. I'm having a bit of a crisis. All of my conflict-free, locally sourced food storages were raided by a band of steampunks, and my U.S. currency is no longer recognized in the Chaz. I'm getting a lot of text messages from my biological guardians, whose basement I recently liberated myself from. But now I have no food, and I'm thinking about reaching back out to them for some aid. Does that compromise my status as a non-binary, full-core, anti-fascist, male-feminist, non-patriarchal, intersectional ally?
Roger, at Cornell University, they have an incredible piece of scientific equipment known as the Tunneling Electron Microscope. Now, this microscope is so powerful that by firing electrons, you can actually see images of the atom, the infinitesimally minute building block of our universe. Roger, if I were using that microscope right now, I still wouldn't be able to locate my interest in your problem.
Think of the fun Dr. Fraser Crane could have taking calls from Chaz residents or citizens every evening. For more on this, Crispin Sartwell joins us. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Dickinson College and author of Entanglements, A System of Philosophy. Crispin, I'm listening. And
Hi, Ben.
You had a good piece. SpliceToday.com is where I saw it. This autonomous zone construct that is in the center of Seattle. Not a new thing. It's one of these classic cases. There's nothing new in the world. It's just the history we don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, that was a tough setup because I have a tendency to try to defend the Chaz.
Yeah, I know. Go ahead.
Chaz. But yeah, the history, I guess it goes back to this kind of wild manifesto of the 1980s by Peter Lamborn Wilson writing under the pen name Hakeem Bey, a thing called the Temporary Autonomous Zone, or TAZ. And it was just kind of this anarchist text that talked about how basically we're not going to be able to have some kind of revolution, we anarchists, but we can maybe carve out these little zones, unpoliced zones, temporarily in the middle of the state or whatever. And I guess that was the model that some people in Seattle were trying to apply to this little six-block area that they carved out last week.
Perhaps it's it was a bit of an overreach to take a police precinct, though. It's such a it's such an embarrassment to Seattle, and
true.
That you can't just. Well, I mean, I guess you could, but it's sort of remarkable that you would relinquish a police precinct to the mob. And what does that say about your control over the city or the confidence residents should have in you governing the city? And so that seems to be maybe where Chaz got overextended.
Well, I mean, it's highly symbolic act. Like I say,
yes.
The way people were thinking about the Chaz is as this unpoliced area, maybe not lasting too long or anything like that. And maybe definitely having some sort of party vibe, actually. It was maybe rather a hedonistic idea as it was first presented in the 80s. But, yeah, the fact that, you know, they took over police precinct, that's highly embarrassing to the authorities, although they're trying to act like they're not embarrassed about that. I guess it happened in Minneapolis in even a worse form.
And as Raz Simone, an heir apparent to Hakeem Bey, is that what Hakeem Bey had in mind?
I don't know much about what Raz does really believe about stuff. I'm not sure what Hakeem Bey actually had in mind. He's an interesting guy in the sense that, like, one thing he did was the history of different odd little interstices in the state, like pirate utopias of the 16th and 17th century, kind of like Pirates of the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. You know, or communes of the 1960s, or, you know, and I guess you can't have that with a police station in the middle of it. So, I mean, that's what made it an autonomous zone. But yeah, it's got to be embarrassing to the authorities, and they've got to be figuring out how they can reassert their authority. I'm not sure Trump is serious about any kind of incursion.
No, I would hope not. Let Seattle chart its own course. They want to do the performance art, the dress rehearsal on reparations they did over the weekend, where every white person has to give $10 to a black person that's part of the Nation of Chaz and all that stuff. That's all well, that's all well and good. But do you worry at all that because this brings together disparate elements, that all it takes is, you know, sort of one Gavrilo princep among the group to really have things spiral in a dangerous way?
It's possible. Yeah, and I think they actually have pulled back from even their own Chaz concept, right? They're calling it the CHOP now.
Right.
The Capitol Hill organized protest or something. So they're, you know, they're emphasizing how organized it is, I suppose, or something. Yeah, they're probably, I mean, people there, I'm sure, are a little worried about that, too. Although I think by all accounts, it's been relatively peaceful, relatively happy. There's been some tight moments or whatever.
Yeah. It's hard to get a handle on it because at the outset, when the police precinct was taken over, the police chief, Carmen Best, talked about robberies and rapes going on inside the occupied area. And then subsequently, you have the authorities talking about this as a block party, a street festival, summer of love. Yeah.
Right. It's very hard to tell because, like, for example, you watch on Fox News and you really get one, you know, very definite picture of chaos and ridiculousness. And you watch even on CNN or whatever, or, you know, I just read a piece in Politico portraying the whole thing extremely positively. And I'm having trouble working out. I'm not in Seattle. I'm in rural Pennsylvania. I'm having a little trouble working out what to believe about what it's like in that place, actually.
Well, when we come back, I just want to get your hand on, and you know, the message you think we take away from Chaz or CHOP, however long it lasts. More with Crispin Sartwell, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Dickinson College and author of Entanglements, The System of Philosophy, right after this.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're talking about the occupied protest area in Seattle with Crispin Sartwell, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Dickinson College. And I just wonder, I know you sort of end your piece on a hopeful note about what a less authoritarian, less government-centric society might look like and how we would interact with one another. But what's your takeaway from how this all transpired in Seattle? What does it say about the future and about the, you know, future leadership of the country under millennials and Gen Zers?
Well, I'm not sure how widespread the particular elements that led to them declaring autonomous zone really are. One thing is, like, this kind of brand of anarchism, Black Brigade anarchism or something, is pretty prevalent in the Pacific Northwest. But it's not the kind of thing I would expect to suddenly break out in a big way in Brooklyn or Atlanta or something like that. Now, and so I'm not sure it really represents the views of a generation in some way, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, though, I think this protest movement overall does to a significant extent. But I'm sure most of these people out here protesting wouldn't in any way describe themselves as anarchists or whatever they're. Although it edges toward that in calls to defund or abolish the police. And I think maybe younger anarchists in the Pacific Northwest saw that slogan and thought to themselves, oh, yeah, okay, so these people are, we should bring these folks along into a kind of anti-statist framework because they're so hostile to the police at this moment.
And so, you know, this piece that Andrew Sullivan wrote a couple of years ago for New York Magazine that has been resuscitated and because of what's transpired, we all live on a college campus now. You're on a college campus.
Yep.
You're seeing what's happening in larger culture. Was Andrew Sullivan prescient?
Yeah, it's interesting. The thing that bothers me, I guess, about millennial politics or even after post-millennial politics and stuff on college campuses is how focused it is on controlling speech and representations.
Yeah.
You know, how obsessed people are. You can see it out there in this movement right now, too, with the pulling down statue. Like, okay, I can understand why you don't like Robert E. Lee looming over your city or whatever, but you're not really accomplishing anything concrete by pulling that down. Like, so on college campuses, it seemed like for some years now, students have been obsessed with controlling the words people use or the exact formulations. Now, I think that maybe this kind of anti-police violence movement and the new civil rights movement doesn't seem to be as focused on that, or like they have, or they're still doing some of that. They seem to have more urgent matters to attend to than you just used the wrong word. So I guess what really bothered me about like campus politics over the last few years has been the, you know, the limitations on free expression.
He is Crispin Sartwell, associate professor of philosophy at Dickinson College and author of Entanglements, A System of Philosophy. Professor Sartwell, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Enjoy it, Dan.
Take care.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Follow us at danproftshow.com for podcasts of the program and on social media at Dan Proft Show as well, Facebook and Twitter. The Jacobin left is telling you, and has been actually for some time, but I think more people are paying attention now as they're engaged in redefinition of things like violence and thievery. So let's just understand where we're at. Kevin Williamson caught this from NPR. Racism as defined by NPR. Racism is the foundation of the society we are in. And to simply carry on with absolutely no active interruption of that system is to be complicit with it. And in that way, we can say that nice white people who really aren't doing anything other than being nice white people are racist. We are complicit with that system. There is no neutral place. And what that really is a working definition of totalitarianism. So now we've moved from you cannot hold that opinion. You cannot hold a heterodox opinion. You have to conform to the opinion as set forward by the cultural mavens in charge of all of our civic institutions. Now you can't just quietly hold that opinion. You have to voice that opinion. You're not allowed to be silent. You're not allowed to disagree, and you're also not allowed to be silent. That doesn't leave you a lot of options. So when people poo-pooed those conservatives like myself who suggested that for many years, let's just go back a few to the Obergefell decision. Oh, you think that tolerance is what they're after. Oh, you think just acceptance, equal footing is what they're after. Wrong. You shall conform to their views and celebrate them. Tolerance is acceptance. Those are new synonyms. Celebration is now a synonym with acceptance and tolerance. So to violate one is to violate all. You understand how it works? And by the way, in part because of yesterday's Supreme Court decision, but not exclusive to it, if it hasn't come to your professional work life yet, if it hasn't come to your kids' school life yet, it is coming. And you've been told your silence is unacceptable. So now you got a choice. It's going to be foisted upon you. Just about everybody. So just be aware of it for those who were so skeptical, as, by the way, some conservatives, Jonah Goldbergs of the world, were, redefinition of marriage, no big deal. No big deal. Didn't see the continuum that we're on. Do you see it now? As Matt Taibbi wrote yesterday, or over the weekend, I should say, in this excellent piece on the media, the American press is destroying itself. This is Matt Taibbi, a man of the left, who, by the way, the Jacobins will be coming for. The American left has lost its mind. It's become a cowardly mob of upper-class social media addicts, Twitter Robespierres who move from discipline to discipline, torching reputations and jobs with breathtaking casualness. And despite that, it continues to gain acolytes. or at least useful idiots, doesn't it? Do you feel like the reasonable crowd is winning? For more on this in the context of November 3rd, we're pleased to be joined by former Chicagoan Joel Pollack, who is also the Breitbart News senior editor at large. He's got a new book coming out. It's coming out next month, July 14th. So get signed up for early release on that. Red November, will the country vote red for Trump or red for socialism? Joel, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you guys.
So how is what we have seen over the last 90 days between the COVID-19 response and the civil unrest that will certainly continue, or both will certainly frame the coming presidential election and all the elections underneath it. How do you think that breaks in terms of acceptance or backlash?
Well, you could have a backlash, and this idea of defunding the police is where the backlash really begins. I don't think you can trust any polls right now because, as you pointed out in your introduction, people are afraid, and they're not going to tell anybody, certainly a stranger, what they actually think about anything. I don't think most Americans agree with what's happening. And as you pointed out, this silence is violence idea is a real threat to our civilization, actually. It's not just a threat politically. It's a threat to the idea that you can live in harmony with people whose ideas are not necessarily the same as your own. If you're forced to express an idea that you don't agree with, then there really is no freedom of speech or freedom of thought. And this confusion about violence is really what's driving a lot of the discourse on the left right now. So on the one hand, they regard silence as violence, but when they actually loot and smash stores and kill law enforcement officers like David Dorn, that's not violence. That's called mostly peaceful. There's been a complete erasure of the distinction between what is actually lawful and legitimate protest versus violence that's used to intimidate other people into submission. So there really is a sense of fear right now in the country, and it's almost a cultural revolution moment. I was one of the first to write about that a couple weeks ago. Maybe I was more in tune with it because Red November is really, in a way, about socialism and about the coming totalitarianism of thought. But this is like a cultural revolution moment. You see young people overthrowing every kind of tradition, every kind of authority, and not really realizing that what they're doing is making the powerful people even more powerful. There's nothing that this is actually going to do to help Black Americans. Much of it will actually hurt Black Americans. And yet, if you tell people you have to say Black Lives Matter, and if you don't, you're part of the problem, you can hide from yourself the fact that you're actually damaging the society that allows people to improve their own lives.
Thinking about November 3rd, it seems to me there's a competition right now in terms of approach to messaging. Joe Biden and the Democrats want to make this a referendum on Trump, and Trump wants to make this a choice, sort of how you framed your book, red for socialism versus Trump for free markets, or red for socialism versus Trump for law and order. But you've got to make it a choice in terms of what kind of America do you want going forward if you're President Trump, and Joe Biden wants to make it a referendum on Trump's, basically, his personality. Do you agree that that's the competition? And if so, who's winning it at present?
Nobody is winning. The American public at the moment, and I'm a fan of President Trump, so take this in the spirit in which it's offered. The American public right now feels as though they have two choices that don't quite meet their needs. On the one hand, you have President Trump, who I think has actually managed the coronavirus and the unrest very well because he got us through the coronavirus. We had enough ventilators. People weren't dying for lack of hospital access like they did in some other countries like Italy. And on the riots and unrest, he stopped that pretty quickly. You know, the media liked to make fun of that walk through Lafayette Park to the church, but that actually was part of a push toward law enforcement, law and order that worked. That's when things started settling down. So I think he managed it well. The problem is that people feel that the way he pushes back, even though I happen to like it, the way he pushes back tends to encourage or at least provoke people who don't like him. And so he's not ending the conflict in a broader societal sense. And as you pointed out at the beginning of the segment, people still feel like they're under siege from these woke mobs and from political correctness. And even though he's fighting against it, he has not turned that corner yet. That just keeps getting worse. So people feel like you have a president who is provocative, and he's not yet succeeded in calming down the situation, returning it to stability. And, you know, his personality is combative, so those provocations are just going to continue. On the other side, you have Joe Biden, who's sitting in his basement in Wilmington, Delaware, completely incapable of managing anything, including his own campaign. And he's responsible in some ways for some of this division. He ran his campaign, he launched his campaign based on the hoax, based on the lie that President Trump sided with neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, which never happened. But imagine saying that, and he keeps repeating it today, saying that the president is essentially a neo-Nazi in the middle of a race riot. Joe Biden is basically encouraging this division, but he's not really in control anymore. And nobody believes Biden can actually manage any way out of this crisis or any other. What you get if you vote for Biden is the team around Biden, and you get basically Bernie Sanders policies and Barack Obama personnel. So the country's looking at this and saying, how do we really get out of this moment? And what Trump has to do, I think, is he has to get people focused back on the issues of the economy, the infrastructure, healthcare, education. Joe Biden could lead on these issues, but Democrats are so wrapped up in race right now and defund the police that they've actually given Republicans a window of opportunity where Republicans can actually take the lead on healthcare, take the lead on education. These are traditionally issues that people associate with Democrats. But because Democrats are busy talking about systemic racism, which nobody really can even define, Joe Biden has left Trump a little window here where if he can come out with policies that speak directly to the anxieties of Americans as we're getting back to work, worried about health insurance, worried about his schools opening in the fall and all of that, he can actually set the country off back in a new direction where people are thinking about recovery instead of dwelling on the present moment.
He is Joel Pollack, Breitbart News Senior Editor at Large. The book, Red November, Will the Country Vote Red for Trump or Red for Socialism? That comes out July 14th. I suppose you could pre-order it on Amazon if you're so inclined, which you should be. Very good. Joel Pollack, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, and always great to talk to you.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and as we have talked about with a number of scholars, perhaps most notably Joel Kotkin and Michael Lind, the real division in America is less along racial lines than it is so-called class lines, even though America is not a caste system. There's still much income mobility, so I hate to speak in class, but what the real dividing line is, setting that aside, the credential that divides, if you will, the college degree. VDH, friend of the show, Victor Davis Hanson, writing in amgreatness.com about this very topic. Nothing is stranger in these tense days than the monotony of the inexact and nondescriptive mantra of white privilege and white solidarity, as if there's some monolithic white block or as if class matters not at all. We have reached the surreal point in which the nation's privileged whites on campuses such as Harvard, Yale, and Stanford, in the top echelon of politics and the corporate and entertainment worlds, all deplore in the abstract something they call white privilege in others who've never really experienced it. Yes, the irony is confounding, isn't it? Well, what to do about it? What to do about this divide? A very sharp piece in Tablet Magazine, tabletmag.com, by a senior writer there named Leal Leibovitz, that will probably be overlooked by many, but it's worth generating a spirited conversation. Hire non-college graduates only. A movement to hire non-college graduates only. How about that? Who would that benefit? Well, we'll get into it. But think about it for a minute. I mean, you know, maybe that's too inexact, as we'll discuss. But if that's the dividing line between opportunity and the lack of opportunity in this country, that transcends racial or gender lines, then why not erase that line? Or at least encourage people to do so voluntarily. He makes this point in a provocative way, opening with the curious Bonnie and Clyde impersonators Garuj Raman and Colin Ford Mattis. These are the two who were arrested last month for throwing a Molotov cocktail at a police car in Brooklyn during the protests in the aftermath of George Floyd's killing. Who are they? Garuj Raman is a graduate of Fordham, as well as its law school. An immigrant from Pakistan, she found a comfortable home in America's meritocracy, writes Leibovitz, which provided her with generous grants to travel to Turkey, Egypt, South Africa, and the Palestinian Authority and write reports about injustices real or imagined. Upon her arrest, her pal Salma Rizvi, a former Obama aide, posted the $250,000 bond to Springer. The other individual, the Clyde of the twosome, Colin Ford Mattis. Mattis grew up in a poor New York neighborhood before attending Princeton University, the son of Jamaican immigrants. Before attending Princeton University and NYU Law School. After a string of coveted internships, including with the San Francisco mayor's office and Microsoft, he landed a job with one of Manhattan's top law firms, pulling in $250,000 a year. In other words, these two are poster children for all that is right in America. Immigrants, or from immigrant families, worked hard, overcame adversity, reaped the kinds of rewards available in America that most of us can only dream of, certainly most of the world can only dream of. So they put all that at risk to throw a Molotov cocktail at a police car in Brooklyn? Why? Leibovitz answers, it's a complicated question, the why, but if you're looking for a one-word answer, here it is, college. If you've spent any time in the sort of institution that shaped the pair of privileged pyromaniacs, you know that the view of America from the quad is grim. Yes, there's great antipathy towards America. And so, here then is a modest proposal from Leibovitz. Stop hiring college grads. Sure, not all alums end up as Playmobil Bobby Seals. It's good. And sure, plenty of protesters, including some college grads, managed to express their moral outrage without fire and brimstones. But committing to hiring non-college grads exclusively will solve all sorts of problems in one fell swoop. And he gives a couple of compelling examples. The New York Times, for instance, like virtually every legacy media outlet, the New York Times expressed this desire to abandon all traditional tenets of journalism and reimagine the newsroom as a grad school seminar room, writing missives about why cartoon dogs, for example, are problematic, or forcing out senior editors for allowing United States senators to express views shared by half the nation. Now imagine a news-gathering operation staffed by human beings who were spared the silliness of academia. Imagine hardworking Americans, level-headed and fair, committing themselves to finding facts and reporting reality rather than dedicating resources to a creative fiction project that reimagines American history as a single glut of racist greed. Well, that is something to imagine, to borrow a John Lennonism. So is this a bit imprecise? Are there college graduates that could also abide that description? Of course. But you get the point that he's making. Imagine a Twitter or Facebook teeming not with overprivileged Maoists who scream out for curbing the speech of their ideological opponents, but with thoughtful and polite high school graduates who are interested in helping people connect with each other effortlessly and respectfully. Apply this thought experiment to nearly every sector of the economy, and you'll see that an influx of diploma-free folks is the solution to many of our problems. By the way, K-12 education, what it's become, as we've documented in some detail on this show, is not exactly absent of the same problem he's describing on college campuses. It just has sort of metastasized by the time you get to young adulthood. But certainly you have the same ignorance present in the teaching and administrative staff in K-12 systems that seeps down into the student body. But again, his point is largely well taken. And he makes one additional point. If you're truly serious about improving the lot of minorities in America, committing to hiring non-college grads non-college grads only, will be a huge boon to people of color. In 2017, for example, black students made up only 13% of the undergraduate population, with only 8% of African-American students attending an elite research institution. And while the percentage of white Americans, 25 to 29, who earned a BA increased from 34% in 2000 to 44% nearly a decade later, only 23% of African Americans now hold a bachelor's degree or higher. So do away with the myth you somehow require a college degree to qualify for a well-paying job, and you may very well see the number of African Americans finding high-paying jobs skyrocket as well. I love expanding the parameters of discussion on this topic, and this is speaking as a college grad and somebody with a law degree. But if that's the dividing line, we should be very aggressive and trying to erase it as an artificial barrier to meritocracy. This is the Dan Prof Show. She could tell right away that I was bad to the bone.
Bad to the bone. Bad to the bone. You're listening to the Dan Prof Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Zeke Emanuel, one of the Emanuel brothers, along with Groucho and Zeppo. He's the doctor. He's Mr. 75 and out. He's concerned that President Trump will issue an emergency authorization in October as his October surprise to emergency use authorization for some vaccine for COVID-19 that is not sufficiently tested in order to declare victory in advance of the November third election. It has a potential to be a travesty, writes Zeke Emanuel. Millions of vaccines could be distributed without proof the vaccine can prevent disease or transmission. So he's very concerned about Trump playing fast and loose with the science. Gosh, imagine a politician playing fast and loose with the science in the era of COVID-19. That would be remarkable, wouldn't it? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Wesley Smith. Of course, he is an author and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, you say it's my sunny disposition this morning. I'm sure you picked up on that. So Zeke Emanuel, you did a little write-up on this for National Review, and you noted, of course, that this is just an assertion of Zeke Emanuel's, much like the candidate he's advising, who just asserts that Trump is going to somehow postpone the November 3rd election without evidence. But that's okay for New York Times publication standards.
Yeah, and one of the things, when I saw that piece, I thought, this is just hysteria. And I have been following Ezekiel Emanuel for a long time because I accept that he's against assisted suicide, interestingly. I am against virtually every one of his positions. He's a technocrat par excellence, meaning he really would like to see authoritarian control in the name of protecting health and wellness in this country with the rule by experts. And so when I saw that he had written this piece in the New York Times, I read it and I thought, this is ridiculous. You know, he has no evidence that Trump could do that. There's no even reason to think that if Trump wanted to do that, that he actually could, because, you know, you do have Dr. Fauci who would say, wait a minute. And you would have to go through the FDA. Other countries would say, wait a second, this thing hasn't even been tested.
Well, not to mention the drug maker themselves that wouldn't want the liability exposure.
Exactly. So, I mean, the idea is preposterous. But then I noticed, because Ezekiel Emanuel is one of the major, in fact, perhaps the major healthcare advisor to the Biden campaign, and I think a potential to become, if Biden wins, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So I thought, gee, if you're going to have a charge in the New York Times, which has destroyed its own credibility by basically allowing adversarial journalists and pundits on the news pages, wouldn't you think that you should at least disclose to the reader that Emanuel is an advisor to the Biden campaign when you're making such a strong charge against the president? And of course, they do not disclose that, because why do anything that would get in the way of the Get Trump agenda, which is what the New York Times is all about these days?
Well, speaking on the topic of coronavirus, it's worth noting in this time of reopening, many states, some states going faster than others, I suppose I should say. Robert Dingwall, over the weekend, he is part of the new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisory group that is advising the British government, saying that, you know, the social distancing, the 2 meters or 6 feet, there's never been a scientific basis for 2 meters. It's kind of a rule of thumb, but it's not like there's a whole lot of a whole kind of rigorous scientific literature that it's founded upon, saying that we cannot sustain social distancing measures without causing serious damage to society, to the economy, and to the physical and mental health of the population. We've actually known that there's no science behind the 6 feet, but where was this guy and other medical professionals for the last 3 months?
Well, that's a good question. And this is the conundrum that we face. People like Dr. Fauci, who are dealing strictly with the pandemic aspect, meaning the viral aspect of what we're going through, they're going to just focus on that one part of the equation. But as Fauci has actually said in one of his news conferences, President Trump and government leaders have to look at the entire picture. And part of this entire picture is, how do we keep this society from imploding to the point where you have a Great Depression, which would be just a disaster for this country? And so you really have, I'm kind of reminded of during the Civil War, and I'm not comparing President Trump to President Lincoln, but President Lincoln had so many balls in the air at once that he had to deal with. And this is one of those kind of crisis moments in which the current president has so many balls in the air and trying to find just the right way of juggling them so that they all don't hit the ground, if you can use that metaphor, is really a difficult part. And part of it is reopening the economy. Just today, I was watching a Maria Bartiromo morning show on Fox Business News, and apparently there's been a huge increase in retail sales. That's wonderful. Yet I worry that there are people in this society who, whether for political reasons or fear of illness and so forth, would rather dampen our ability to thrive in the name of fighting disease. And we can't allow that to happen either.
When we come back with Wesley Smith, I want to talk about some studies that suggest lessons learned from the lockdowns and what could have been and perhaps prospectively will be better responses to viral outbreaks like COVID-19. More with Wesley J. Smith when we return.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Wesley Smith, and I want to reference this piece in the Wall Street Journal by a couple of research fellows, one at Stanford's Hoover Institute, the other at the Naval Postgraduate School in the Wall Street Journal, about the data. A team of economists from MIT published the results of a study that compared various alternative strategies for limiting the spread. They concluded twice as many lives could be saved if governments focused limited resources on protecting the most vulnerable people, rather than squandering them on those who seem to face almost no risk, such as children, which is to your point about vaccine prioritization, and also to the larger point about, you know, not being confined to the binaries that the politicians have set forward, social distance or not social distance, but being open-ended with respect to what are the best policies that provide the best trade-offs for humanity. And those questions seem to have been completely lost as you just turn half the population into parrots repeating lines they hear politicians speak on TV.
Yeah, and what's really disturbing is what New York, New Jersey, and some other places where the worst of the disease occurred, and yet the governor of New York issued an order requiring infected COVID patients to be accepted by nursing homes, which led to a devastation in those homes, thousands of deaths. And that is something that I think is really a problem, because the implication of that order is that we care about elderly people and frail people less than we care about other people. And that's a form of invidious discrimination that I think we have to really be careful about when we are dealing with any kind of serious pandemic or epidemic.
Yeah, I mean, there's no lessons learned from New York State, the epicenter of the outbreak. It's remarkable. Cuomo's the nation's governor, according to the reporting I see on CNN and MSNBC, largely in the New York Times. I mean, the Wall Street Journal had a huge expose on Friday that was rather devastating for the small percentage of people that read it. about New York State's response, not just with respect to reintroducing the infected into nursing homes, which was the most catastrophic decision that governors, and it wasn't just Cuomo, it was Wolf in Pennsylvania, it was Whitmer in Michigan, the worst decision that governors made, and it gets barely any coverage because the worst offenders were Democrats. In addition to that, there was the squabbling going on between Cuomo and de Blasio where they're, you know, sort of playing the yardstick game rather than focusing on making decisions in a coordinated fashion between the state and the city. And not all of this is papered over by the press corps. And frankly, conservative outlets haven't done a good enough job of profiling this either.
Yeah, and there's another problem we have is the collapse of trust in institutions. So you saw, just as one example, the yelling about you can't have any kind of close contact during the pandemic. And then when the demonstrations and mass demonstrations took place in the wake of the death of George Floyd, suddenly that was over. And you actually had de Blasio's family participating in some of these marches. You saw, I believe, the governor of Michigan. And then as soon as those demonstrations are over, as I saw one commentator say, well, suddenly they remembered COVID. Well, you can't have that kind of hypocrisy without people noticing. And when you have that kind of hypocrisy and double standard, the credibility of the institution collapses. Here's another example. The World Health Organization, and I wrote about this, they issued a statement one day saying that transmission from people who are asymptomatic is, quote, very rare, close quote, which is really, you know, if that's true, it's an excellent thing because that means that the disease is far less dangerous than people suppose because people were so worried that asymptomatic people could actually spread the disease not knowing they were ill. Well, suddenly, because that might help one side of the political argument, the pressure, you could see it, the pressure was on the WHO. Take it back. And guess what? The very next day they took it back. Oh, well, actually, this is what it's true, and that 16% of the people who are asymptomatic and spread the disease or whatever they said it was. So you had no credibility from the WHO because you know that they're political. And, of course, we knew that before when they hid what China was doing. When you have our major institutions engaging in that kind of clear political bias or incompetence, I don't know which, people lose faith in institutions. And that leads to a real problem in civic society because our institutions aren't there to tell us what to do, but they're there to give us leadership and advice so we can follow when that's our desire. And who do you follow these days? It's very difficult to know.
Since you write so much on the topic of bioethics, what about, and it's remarkable coming from the crowd it's coming from, too, with respect to their general positions on life in the womb and life at the end of life, but everything to save one life. If you save one life, Wesley, that should be the basis of our public policy.
Right. And even though that everything to save one life might cost $5,000 on the other side, it doesn't matter. That's just a bromide. That's just a little slogan that people use to justify everything. Here's a larger problem. We've become a society that feels instead of thinks. And when you feel, what is right or wrong at a particular moment is based on your feelings, there's no principles involved because your feelings are your feelings. They're transitory. What you think is right today what you feel is right today, you may not feel is right tomorrow. That's why thinking becomes important. And I always try to not say, how do you feel about this? I always try to say, what do you think about this? Because I think that distinction is really crucial. And I think as a society, we need to feel less and ponder and have principles and follow ideas more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no question. The sentimentality leads to the descent into barbarism. Wesley Smith, author and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. I know the market rallied today on the good news of the May retail numbers, but I just want to go back to this. This cannot be repeated enough as we're still trying to gather the information that tells us what kind of economic devastation we inflicted upon ourselves, at least some of ourselves, with these lockdown policies. 41%, again, this National Bureau of Economic Research, between February and April, the number of active businesses by demographic that were eliminated, gone. 41% black-owned businesses, gone. 41% of all black-owned businesses, gone. 32% of all Latino-owned businesses, gone. Immigrant-owned businesses, 1.1 million or 36%. Women, 25%. The industries that were most hurt in terms of the number of businesses in the industry, gone. Arts, leisure, hotels, down 35%. Construction, down 27%. Repair and maintenance, down 25%. Transportation, down 22%. Restaurants, down 22%. Not a bad quarter, not down year over year, gone. So you can understand why politicians that are dismissive of the concerns of the yeomanry, to borrow a Joel Kotkinism, getting hammered, as those numbers speak to, bubbles over. Phil Murphy, New Jersey governor, you know him. He's the governor who said the Constitution is above his pay grade. He was on the Today Show yesterday on the occasion of New Jersey finally moving to allow outdoor seating at restaurants, and was interviewed with Savannah Guthrie about the fight the state had with Asbury Park and the Jersey Shore. Here's what he had to say.
You had to go to court, actually, a fight with Asbury Park. The local town wanted to have indoor dining restaurants starting last weekend. In the end, you won in court, but the larger battle is going on literally as we speak. Amen. There are business owners who are enraged that this reopening hasn't happened sooner.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you mentioned this. We were the second hardest hit state in America, over 12,600 fatalities. The virus indoors is far more lethal than when it's outdoors. So we got to be very careful about opening up things that are inside, lack of ventilation, close proximity. We'll get there. There's no question we'll get there. We're just not ready yet.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know if people can hear it. We have a heckler who's yelling about this very thing. I mean, this rage that people feel about businesses not being opened fast enough, it's real. Why aren't you moving more quickly? You know, a lot of business owners say it's kind of arbitrary. Why can I walk to Home Depot and with 100 people, but I can't go have a meal?
Yeah, this guy deserves to say what he wants to say. But honestly, overwhelmingly, the majority of folks get it.
Yeah, well, the majority doesn't make something the right call. A majority get it means support what the governor did out of fear. We'll see where they are in 30 days and in 60 days and 90 days, as the full extent of the damage is realized. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Please do again tomorrow.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.